We've come a long way from the time when the only route to parenthood was heterosexual procreation. We can form families through sperm and egg donation, IVF, gestational surrogacy, and adoption, meaning families can be headed by same-sex couples, single people, and folks of all genders. And with all of these advancements, it might be time to reconsider whether biology is what bonds parents and children, or if it's something else. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The reality is many prospective parents continue to romanticize the ability to raise children with whom we share a genetic bond. And my guest worries that that mindset is to the detriment of lots of individual children and maybe our entire society. Leo Kim is an ideas contributor at Wired, where you can find his essay, Preferring Biological Children is Immoral, part of Wired's series about the future of morality, the next normal. Leo, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you shared this conversation you had recently with a close friend about his interest in becoming a parent someday. He was excited about the possibility, but it sounds like he had some conditions in mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, as these conversations kind of evolve and we're just talking through hypotheticals, I asked him if he'd be interested in adopting, and he expressed that he would really prefer not to because he wants his kid to be kind of quote unquote directly related to him. And, you know, I think he was a little sheepish about it at first, and sort of that caught my attention because I think that was something that I'd always sort of taken for granted growing up, but I did sense that it sort of indicated a larger culture shift in sort of where our moral intuitions were heading. And so that's something that really kind of inspired this piece and sort of the further investigation that it sort of opened up.
It is a fairly common, if not always welcome thing to ask young adults if they want to have children someday. Why do you think we ask so much less often how they imagine they would have children?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that it's because for, you know, most of history, it was kind of, there was only really one way to kind of do things. Or, I mean, you could, adoption is an age-old practice, but, you know, I think that what we thought was that, you know, the only way to have, to produce kind of new life was through this one way of kind of heterosexual, like sexual reproduction. And, you know, over the past couple of decades, new practices have come out, ranging from IVF to sort of gestational surrogacy, that have shown us that what we once thought was necessary is really kind of contingent, and that there are ways that children can kind of come to life that circumvent the sort of pathways that we've always taken as like the sort of sole alternative. So I think that we're just not used to asking these sorts of questions because these questions are still really new in culture, which means that our moral intuitions regarding them are still really being kind of codified and set in place.
Is it your sense that people these days have an obligation to interrogate their own assumptions about parenthood, even if they can have children in the sort of traditional, most common way?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that more people are doing so. I think that, you know, at this like non-academic level, there's been a real big culture shift with regards to family. I mean, growing up, it was a simple given that, you know, you'd marry, have kids, and all that feels a little less settled now. I mean, on the far end, you have an increasingly vocal contingent talking about their decision to not have children at all. You can look at any recent like Seth Rogen interview on him and his wife's decision, and it inevitably comes up. And family types that simply weren't acknowledged as legitimate in the past are finally being recognized. And so all that means that it seems like our long-held assumptions around what counts as a family are being shaken up. And I think that, you know, when you get this sort of open space, there's a lot of value in sort of interrogating why you think what you do and just sort of reflecting on the decision, because it's a monumental one, maybe the biggest decision, you know, most people will ever make. And so I think being really clear in why you're making that decision goes a long way.
Well, you explained this term biologism, which is what this essay is really all about. First of all, is that your word or did someone else coin it?
It's a word in sort of bioethics discourse that I've kind of appropriated for the sake of the essay, but it's one that's been kind of theorized in the sort of bioethics space before me, long before me.
So what does it mean precisely?
Yeah, I think, you know, in short, it's just the prioritization of biological inheritance when it comes to just having a child, just preferring that a child is biologically related to you, opposed to sort of any other relation. I think at its core, it just tries to like name that that preference that we have.
So I found this essay so interesting because it pointed out to me something that I had never given much conscious thought to before. And full disclosure, I'm the parent of two biological children and two stepchildren. So I suppose I have a dog in this fight. how do you think that Western culture in particular shapes the way modern parents tend to have an overwhelming preference for children to whom they're biologically related?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think that, you know, at least in the sort of modern kind of family unit, I mean, I think that we've moved towards one, a really nuclear family unit. And there, I think that it's sort of grounded in a certain sort of heteronormative, like, family relation. I think that Western culture has really been trying to naturalize a certain vision of family, arguing that, you know, this is just how things are. But I think that the challenge is that what is natural is sort of always contested. It's really hard to identify what is natural and what is not. And so I think that the move that's been made is to switch this question from one of culture, which I think it really is, to one of objectivity or science or what is natural. And I think that the move that has sort of happened that we're starting to become a little bit more suspicious of is, you know, I think culture has taught us that certain things just are the way they are, and that you should not think about them further because that's just kind of our natural condition. And I think it's reappropriating those sort of distinctions back into the domain of culture that I think is what kind of leads to this sort of conversation.
Yeah, your essay made me think about the fact that for many centuries in Western culture, it was simply assumed and understood that, like, women had inferior intellectual capacities to men and physical capacities as well. That was just seen as so obviously natural and, you know, as to not be questioned. Now we live in a society where we don't only question that, we know it to be untrue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that when you kind of expand that into the domain of you know, like childbearing, I mean, the bioethicist Enzio DiNucci, I believe, has this term called, you know, patriarchal prejudices. And it's basically the idea that because a mother is a source of this sort of gestational biological kind of bond with the child, it's only natural that they should serve as a primary caretakers. And we just know, like, how much actual kind of inequality that results in when we place this sort of obligation on only one partner. And I think that the sort of argument that this comes from some sort of natural source, it lies into, you know, systems of oppression or just sort of inequality that we would rather do away with.
How do we end up viewing biological children as ideal within a family because they represent a kind of extension of ourselves and our identities?
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of people want to have someone who is, you know, biologically related to them because they want to see sort of the similarities, you know, they want to see themselves in this other person. And I think that that's totally kind of legitimate. And I get why that'd be a deep desire. I do think, though, that kind of research shows that that similarity can be something that, you know, emerges from all sorts of family units. Like, adopted children can, you know, have a lot of similar traits to their parents because of the way that they were raised. And so I think that when you kind of get down to our real desires, a lot of them, biology might be proximate to them, but they're not necessary for any of them. And I think that, you know, what people really would want is to love another really deeply and care for them in a way that kind of transcends self. And I think that's perfectly compatible with people who aren't genetically related. It just so happens that for most of history, it was just kind of those two were always tied together. So we never really learned how to make that distinction.
How does that particular reverence for children who have biological ties to the two parents raising them affect the way we perceive families formed by different means, by adoption or surrogacy or sperm or egg donation or something else?
Yeah, I think they're, you know, maybe less so now, but at first there was a lot of anxiety around that fact. You know, you get this idea of the natural family unit, and that starts to exclude groups that we don't see as natural. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that same argument was leveraged against queer couples looking to adopt because that wasn't quote unquote natural. Before that, it was, you know, interracial couples shouldn't exist because that's unnatural. And so I think that, you know, you really see this anxiety kind of playing out in these spaces where, like, new family units are emerging and kind of the culture is initially resistant. But I think, as we've seen in the past, you know, it was a mistake to think that way. And I think that projecting it into the future, which I think this whole Next Normal series is all about, we can see sort of how the innate biases that we have now might sort of be in conflict with those kind of higher order desires that we have.
So, Leo, there will be people listening, and I imagine you've received emails from people who feel the same way, who note that this desire for biological children is somehow bigger than us and our culture, because most of us have a natural evolutionary desire to reproduce. What is your response to that?
Yeah, and that's, I think, really kind of gets at the crux of this entire debate. I think that, you know, on the one hand, it's important to sort of like think about what we mean when we say the word natural. I think that often we leverage that idea to sort of like keep on doing the things that we already want to be doing. But there's like a lot of conflict there, because I think that it's really unclear what we mean. So often, you know, there are so many counterexamples that abound. There are groups in the world that don't have a social category for biological fathers. Does that mean that the category of father is not natural, or that that group is somehow wholly unnatural? Some animals reproduce asexually. Does that mean sexual reproduction is unnatural just because asexual reproduction exists? Our close chimp cousins like to throw feces. Is that natural? Is it wrong for us not to? These are silly examples, but I think they just show how hard it is to identify what's natural for us and what's not. And when we look at it up close, the quote-unquote natural human seems a little bit hazier and more illusory. We're all social creatures, and if there's one quote-unquote natural fact about us, it's probably that. And creatures necessarily wed to a certain kind of culture, so trying to disentangle the two becomes really difficult. And, you know, I this is a little corny, but when I think about what is natural for humans, if such a thing exists, it's not like that we have some mechanical desire to reproduce. I think, you know, what makes us unique in many regards is the fact that we have the ability to love and care for each other beyond kin or clan, to love in this indiscriminate whole manner. And I think if there's a part of us that we want to kind of exercise, it's that part over this sort of reproductive part.
So why do you think culture really pushes back against the kinds of ideas that you're talking about in the way that it, say, really sanctifies motherhood? You know, like, pregnancy is a beautiful thing, but we really sort of act as if this is, you know, the apex of a woman's potential existence, is to conceive and bear a child.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think on the one hand, it's because that sanctification upholds a certain sort of dynamic, economic, social kind of dynamic that I think makes it easier for some parties to, you know, not worry about childcare, or, you know, that places a responsibility on a certain group of people. And I think that sanctification goes a long way in maintaining that sort of system. And, you know, this is a difficult topic. It's something that a lot of people don't think explicitly about. And, you know, when someone comes and says, like, hey, morals are changing, even though you took it for granted for so long, like, you know, like, it's going to be different. I mean, that's unsettling. And it's totally fair to sort of hear this and feel uncomfortable with it. And I think that, you know, as we think about how morals will change, that sort of discomfort, I think, is a sign that we're really touching on something substantive, that, like, I think, you know, regardless of where you stand on it, we need to figure out what to do with this and what to do with these changes. And I think that it's really just a kind of prompt to get people to think about and reflect about, like, this decision more than anything else.
I have to ask, Leo, I mean, you were inspired to write this essay after having a conversation with a friend. Surely you were aware of just how provocative this might be. What has the response been from readers?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, people have been very sort of energized about the piece. I think a lot of people have felt, I think there's a lot of kind of misunderstanding that's gone around the piece to start off. I think that, you know, the argument isn't that you should not love your biological children. It's not that we should never have biological children again. It's just the simple fact is that, you know, when you're deciding to have a child, there's, I think, reasons that we think are legitimate and less legitimate. Like, if I was having a kid just to have a tax dependent, that would be a sort of bad reason. On the other hand, if you're having a child because you want to love someone outside yourself in a wholly self-sacrificing way, I think that's a beautiful reason. And so I think the question is, where does the desire to specifically have someone that's related to you kind of sit on that spectrum? And, you know, I think it's sort of, it's not something that should necessarily motivate the decision. Now, there will people will continue to have biological children in the future. That is right. And that is, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's just the fact that the motivation there shouldn't necessarily be just for the sake of passing on your genes. That feels a little kind of shallow to me. But more that, you know, like, adoption can be difficult. You might not agree with adopting. IVF is expensive. There's a lot of obstacles for these other avenues, and it's not like they're necessarily preferable to having a biological child. It's just that, you know, the biology is a little bit more secondary than it is primary, I think, when you're looking at, like, how we should categorize the reasons that motivating this decision.
Is the desire for a biological child or no child, does that feel to you like it's setting a condition on your ability to love that child? Like, it's less than unconditional love if you say, I can love a child that I'm biologically related to, but not another child.
I think so. And, you know, my hope is that if it turns out that I was, like, swapped at birth, my parents would love me the same and that they wouldn't start preferring my brother who is, like, biologically related to them. And so I think that, you know, this virtue of parenthood and of unconditional love there is, I think, a wonderful one to exercise. And I think that getting rid of this sort of preference opens you up to being able to exercise it in a more maybe kind of robust or fleshed out way.
It has occurred to me that we all have a certain amount of, or many of us, I should say, have a certain amount of hubris. I'll start by saying I don't think anyone who doesn't want a child should have one, full stop, because it's too much work and too great a commitment to sort of force anyone into this position. But I've heard people say, well, I wouldn't want to adopt a child because what if that child effectively is imperfect, right? Has some problem down the line. And, like, there's just no guarantee with biological children that you won't pass down some problem or experience challenges in raising that child.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, a question really is, like, where do our obligations to each other come from? And I think that historically we've had a pretty bad time whenever we've tried to ground those relationships in things like genetics. And I think that ultimately they stem from this decision that you make to become a parent and to love this other person, you know, unconditionally and do the best that you can for them. And I think that, you know, nothing... It's a difficult journey, and I don't think it'll ever be truly perfect for anyone. But I do think that being open to the imperfections and sort of being open to kind of letting that child be their own person goes a really long way.
We have entered an era in which would-be parents can screen embryos to implant. And the idea, I think, is to select embryos that are not at risk for devastating genetic illnesses. But that's not the only way this technology could be used.
Yeah. And it's a really tricky question, made all the more difficult because of our really unfortunate history of eugenics in this country. You know, tens of thousands of people were forcibly sterilized in the past century due to perceived genetic, quote unquote, deficiencies. So, you know, we're rightfully concerned when talk of genetics intersects with questions of, you know, reproduction and sort of children. But yeah, like you said, at the same time, you have all these genetic screening and selection technologies entering our practices. So it's not like we can simply ignore the question. We have to figure out where we're willing to draw the line. And, you know, I think our intuitions have largely settled around the fact that people seem to think that it's okay to consider a child's genes if it's to prevent harm, like you said, in potentially fatal conditions like Tay-Sachs, Huntington's. But it's not really that valid when it's anything beyond that. Things like height, weight. I don't think we want to necessarily be screening for those, because I think that really veers us back into the territory of eugenics-like thinking that I think we've done so much work to try and kind of get ourselves out of. And so the question is, where does genetic relatedness sit on that spectrum? And I think the real question is, does being genetically related to a parent help prevent harm? And, you know, I think the research can be split on this, but there's a lot of research that indicates that self-actualization doesn't come from relatedness, but, you know, surprise, how a parent treats their child, as well as research that shows that infant adoptions can result in kind of mother-child bonds that show no differences in quality of attachment. So it seems like relatedness isn't necessary to having a flourishing life. And so it doesn't seem like there's, it sort of meets that baseline criterion that a lot of our moral intuitions have settled around.
Is there any evidence at all that a parent with biological ties to a child would be less likely to abuse or neglect that child or just be a bad parent?
I don't think so. And I think that, you know, a lot of the sort of married versus unmarried couples, like I think there's research that indicates, you know, let's say like married couples might like have a wealthier household than unmarried couples. But I think that that mistakes causation for correlation. I think marriage comes with a lot of social and economic benefits in this country. And so, you know, it's not necessarily because somehow marriage is, you start with marriage being super special and that's where these things come from. But often it's just that certain family structures tend to benefit from the system in ways that other family structures don't. And I think the solution there isn't to make sure everyone conforms to that one family structure, but rather to adapt the system so that more family structures receive the benefit that, you know, a select kind of number are now.
I'm old enough that I grew up with a lot of people who happened to be adopted. My husband was adopted. Did you hear a lot from adoptees about their perspective on this piece?
Yeah. And I think that the reactions were, you know, kind of covered a wide swath. So I don't want to be reductive and kind of characterize it in any one way. But I mean, I think there were people who really expressed like, yes, of course, my adopted parents, like, love me unconditionally. And I think that like this sort of preference for biology is kind of really strange and kind of unhealthy, makes me feel like something could be wrong with me, even though it's not. And on the other hand, I think there's a really fair criticism for the adoption industry as a whole. You know, it's an industry that's been rightfully accused of kind of, you know, racism, classism, these sort of exploitative economic relationships between countries. And so, you know, this isn't necessarily to say that adopting is full stop right. And I don't think it should be taken as a passive endorsement of the sort of adoption industry as it stands. I think there's a lot of work to be done there. And so I think it's a really complicated answer for a lot of people. I think a lot of people feel like they've been forced to participate in this sort of exploitative practice, and there's a lot of hurt there. And so I think I want to be very careful to like make sure that like this piece isn't misconstrued as a blind like you know, like approval of adoption industry as it stands now. I think there's a lot of practices to be remedied so that, you know, when it does happen, it happens in the way that's best for all the parties involved.
You imply strongly in the piece that it's something of a myth that there is a shortage of adoptable children looking for homes, that it's not as if there are many parents who would like to adopt a child, that those children don't exist. Can you talk about what you learned about that?
Yeah. I mean, it is a narrative that's gone back, you know, over five decades. You know, I think that adoption is more kind of competitive now. There's no denying that. But children still do need to be adopted. There are still people in sort of like these institutions and kind of care systems that would benefit greatly from it. So I think that, you know, that's more to say that argument shouldn't necessarily be used to kind of preclude people from looking at that avenue. It might be more difficult now, and it might have reached a point, like an inflection point, where it's so difficult that it doesn't really make economic or sort of logistical sense for a lot of families. And that's totally legitimate. But I think that what I worry about is if that narrative sort of gains a lot of traction, the backlash to it would just be for people to kind of forget that option exists as a whole, which I certainly don't think we should do.
There's also the question of transracial adoptions, which are, the relationships within the family may be similar to what they would be in any family, but, you know, transracial adoptees also have to navigate the outside world. Is it appropriate to try and match adoptive parents with a child who has a similar racial or ethnic background?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question. And I think that, you know, I think that's one of those really thorny questions that I'm not sure if there's an objectively correct answer to. What I will say, though, is I think that any parent that's kind of raising a child of a different kind of ethnicity or race needs to, I think, be very conscious in, you know, like working both on themselves and just making sure that they're able to do that respectfully and sort of appropriately. I think that it takes more work, I think, to educate yourself in that manner. But I think that that's kind of part and parcel of what happens when those sort of adoptions occur. I think it really is a case-by-case situation here, depending on sort of, you know, like the alternatives available. But I do think that it's definitely something that the parents should be very kind of sensitive towards, and, you know, just acknowledge that they'll need to do the work to make sure that this person can be raised in a healthy way that sort of helps them navigate the world in as kind of full of a sense as possible.
How do you think that growing concerns about climate change and other kind of existential challenges to human existence might coalesce with a pushback against biologism in our country, against the preference for biological children?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, the purpose of this sort of essay series, I think, and it's helpful to sort of ground it in that, is to anticipate the future of moral norms. It's not necessarily to say that they're objectively right or objectively wrong, but, you know, just to say, like, how are things shifting? What are the cultural vectors that we're experiencing? And, you know, like, how will that sort of change how we think about morals in the future? And I do think that there's a just general pessimism with regards to the future that I think really heavily intersects with our desire to have families and have kids. I mean, there are, on the far end, people who term themselves antinatalists, who basically think it's wrong to bring any new life into this world. They think that humankind is just bad for the planet, and life's pains are worse than its pleasures are good. Like, a slap to the face is worse than a bite of cake is good. I don't necessarily agree with this line of reasoning, but I think more and more people are, you know, kind of feeling the pressure of the world weighing on them. You know, outlook for children is not that great now. You know, I think before it was guaranteed that your kids would be better off than you were. That's no longer the case. I think that as the sort of environment becomes a bigger issue, people are really reexamining, you know, whether or not it feels right to kind of bring new life into the world. And I think a lot of people are kind of beginning to kind of consider that decision really thoughtfully and landing in the side of, like, maybe not now. And I think that that doesn't have to do anything with biological children directly. But I think that insofar as a biologically related child will always be a new child, I do think that that sort of kind of begins to, like, cast a shadow on that decision a little bit.
I'm sympathetic to that line of thinking. I understand where it comes from. And it comes often from a place of, you know, caring for a child that doesn't even exist, if you want to think about it that way. It also occurs to me, though, Leo, that every generation imagines that they are living through the absolute best and also the absolute worst that humankind has ever had to deal with. You know, you think about people even a century ago before vaccines and antibiotics and the prospects that their children would even live to adulthood probably looked pretty grim.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that, you know, like, yeah, we didn't start the fire. And it really is a case where these sort of anxieties have been hovering around for a long time, which is why I don't necessarily, I think, agree with the sort of antinatalist way of thinking. And I think it sort of positions us as necessarily bad for the environment when I think we can do a lot of good. Like, despite how sort of pessimistic this piece can seem at times, maybe, I think deep down I am an optimist in our ability to kind of right the wrongs that we've done and to kind of cohabitate the world in a better way. And so I think that, you know, these anxieties have always motivated people to not have children and maybe will kind of continue motivating them further as they intersect with broader kind of changes. But I don't think that'll kind of result in a full scale stop of, you know, like kind of the decision to have children or anything like that.
I think unless all your headshots online are very old, that you're a relatively young person. Do you mind if I ask your age or approximate age?
Yeah. I'm 28.
Okay, so do you think this is a different and weightier decision for your generation than it might have been for your parents?
It seems like I think so. And I just do think that our generation is really kind of taking a step back and, I don't know, like reflecting on it more, the culture seems to have sort of shifted to, you know, from it being more of a sort of default that you, I don't know, that I felt like I would always do into something that I think people are just sort of kind of considering. And I think that these sort of technological changes, environmental changes have all just given us this moment of like pause and reflection. And being fully honest, I'm not sure where we'll go after that reflection. Maybe we'll, you know, just decide that no, it's still worth it. Maybe a lot of people won't, but I do think that the sort of ability to take this time and have this space to kind of actually like reflect deeply on this decision is something that at least a lot of my peers are experiencing. And I do find that it felt more unique than at least, you know, when I speak to my parents, their sort of kind of decision to have a child.
How do you think that questioning the preference for biological children could destabilize racial hierarchies over time?
Yeah, I think that at the core of this biological preference is, you know, how we choose to relate to each other and sort of the grounds for our social relations. I think that genetic provenance has long been used as a tool to kind of uphold like things like white hegemony in the US. You can think of the legacy of like the one drop rule that really framed whiteness as something of like having to do with ancestral purity. And I think that, you know, that is in sort of essence like a system that uses genetics as a way to, you know, like I guess ground our moral relations and also our social relations with each other. And I think that, you know, this push against the desire for biological children kind of is just part of a larger push in decentering biology in our social relations. I think that, you know, when we start to do that and when we start to open up our ways of relating to each other for people who are wholly dissimilar to us, I think we have a more kind of universal like ability to kind of, I don't know, relate to each other and get along and sort of build a polity together. I think it kind of helps the fragmentation and atomization of social relations that we've seen over the past couple of decades.
It is far easier for many couples who want a child to conceive a biological child than to adopt one. And this is a little bit of a conundrum, right? Because we want vulnerable children placed with people who are well suited to love and care for them. But becoming a parent by any means other than sexual reproduction introduces a whole lot of third-party gatekeepers into what feels like a very private decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I think, to start off, it's totally fair if that is too much of a challenge for parents. I think that, you know, there's a big distinction between a preference, a biological preference that motivates your decision, and one that's merely a sort of byproduct of it. I think if there are hurdles in terms of, you know, like logistics, like economics, whatever, keeping, you know, parents from adopting, and they choose to have a biological child, that's totally fair. And I think that's very different from someone who has that child specifically to pass on their genes. So I think, you know, there's one part of that there. And I think that kind of forces us to re-examine the systems of adoption and the systems of kind of non-traditional reproduction and just ask, like, are there ways that we can make it more open, that we can make it more ethical? Like I mentioned kind of earlier in our conversation, I think that there's a lot of challenges and legitimate qualms to be had with the adoption industry as it stands now. And I think that the hope is that more attention to it as an alternative will help remedy some of those kind of challenges or imperfections in the system. You could worry that it might exacerbate them, and I think that's very fair. But I do think that at baseline, we need to sort of examine those gates and those gatekeepers and kind of, you know, do more to make sure that we're doing it in the most kind of ethical way possible.
Your story also made me think about the family tree exercises that are like universal in elementary schools all over the United States. And there are reasons for doing these, but it has long occurred to me that in any given elementary school class, there are going to be a number of children whose family trees do not sort of match the structure that the teacher has given them.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And, you know, I think that it brings up questions of, you know, like how far we should leverage this sort of like anti-biologist kind of thinking. I think that the resistance towards biology and sort of structuring our relations can be taken too far, and it can be, you know, weaponized against marginal populations. I think that there's a lot of people who find a lot of value in rediscovering, you know, your genetic ancestry through DNA tracing, especially if you are of, you know, like the descent of, you know, like slaves in the U.S. I think there's like history has broken a lot of, you know, familial bonds and ties, and it has caused a lot of families to be ruptured in this way. And I do think that sort of DNA testing and these things can help rectify that history. And so I think that we should be sensitive for how we apply this sort of, you know, non-biologist thinking to these kind of issues that are intertwined in other sorts of like social histories and kind of traumas.
Do we need to rethink the way those of us who do have biological ties to our ancestors that we know of, you know, the people among whom we were raised, yeah. Do we need to rethink our sense that what they did that was amazing or abhorrent has anything to do with us?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that when we're thinking about legacies, there's two legacies we can also talk about. There's one that's solely grounded in kind of, you know, this genetic line that takes us all the way up to, you know, the beginning of life. But I think there's another kind of lineage that is based on, I think, lines of people who have cared for each other. You know, the sort of lineage of care that's been passed down and let people flourish over time. And I think that those kind of like social lineages are, you know, more important or more have more value to me, I think, than the genetic one. I think that lets you reflect on all the good that's been done throughout the family tree. It also like lets you reflect on the things that maybe like positioned you in the way that they are now that could be, you know, for better or for worse. And so I think that when we're fascinated with the family tree, I think what we're really fascinated about are those sort of social lines. And the genetic line is often tied to that, for sure. But I do think that the history that I think matters to me, at least, is the sort of social history of kind of care and love that's been passed down from generation to generation.
As a young man of what we might call childbearing age, I wonder what you make of declining birth rates, not just in the U.S., but literally all over the world. What is that about, do you think? Besides, is it only driven by anxiety about the future, or is there something else at work?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I know that there's been plenty of research done indicating that, you know, as kind of countries enter like higher kind of economic strata, the kind of birth rate declines. And I think that a lot of that can kind of be, I don't know, ascribed to changes in kind of economic structure. If you just need less hands around the house or, you know, you have more time to invest in like one child. So I think that there's a lot of things, including kind of like, you know, economic models that kind of go into that declining kind of birth rate. Definitely anxiety is, I think, part of it. Although I do think that the anxiety, I would think, is a little bit more sort of like a contemporary thing. So I don't think that it's necessarily ascribable to the general trend that's been experienced over the past couple of decades. But yeah, I definitely think that that's, I know, a very kind of pressing challenge for a lot of the sort of economists trying to figure out like how we should structure the economy of tomorrow to make way for the fact that, you know, the population rate of population increase is going to be a lot kind of slower than it is today.
If we decide as a society, Leo, to agree with the premise of your essay that a preference for biological children over children who become part of our families through any other means is not okay, do we then have an obligation as a society to make it easier, less expensive, less burdensome for people to become parents by other means?
Yeah, I think that would be a great start. And I think that giving people more options is certainly, I think, like the beginnings of a maybe more equitable sort of system. I also think that, you know, the change happens, I think, will happen structurally. I also think it'll just kind of happen in how people reflect on their decision to have children. You know, like I said, the act of having biologically related children is not going anywhere. it's people will continue to do it. And I think that really what will sort of change is the fact that, you know, when you ask someone why they're having a child, maybe it'll be maybe less common for people to say it's because they just want someone who's related to them, and more common to cite, you know, the infinite other sort of like really deep and wonderful reasons that you would want to have a child. And so I think, you know, at its core, this piece is really just sort of pushing against that sentiment. I mean, there's a lot of fantastic reasons to have a child. Wanting to spread your genes is a little bit of a weird one. And I think that I'm just trying to diagnose that as a little strange and something that'll probably fall by the wayside in the years to come.
How do you think our society would be different if we didn't consider it the default and therefore best possible option to have our children through sexual reproduction? I mean, that's how we have them, but it may not be our sexual reproduction.
Right. No, I think that, you know, it would kind of open us up to re-examining, like, basic units like family. And I know that's always a topic that really, I think, like, raises a lot of eyebrows. And then it's, you know, like, people are concerned about what that might look like. But I think that there's a lot of kind of research, I think, coming out on sort of, and I know I've read a lot on the sort of loneliness epidemic going on, how we lack sort of like the social ties that we maybe had in the past, and how we've kind of retreated into this nuclear family unit that maybe doesn't allow for as much sort of social breadth. And I think it gives us a chance to reflect on that base unit and to just think about if there are ways that we might be able to have households or kind of social communities that break out of that like atomic mold to let us, I think, relate to each other in a more sort of open, porous, and kind of flexible way. And in ways that I think would ultimately maybe lead to just deeper connection with other people and a kind of more robust social net.
It's a really interesting point. I mean, our intensive focus on the nuclear family is all most of us have ever known, at least if we grew up in this country. This is a relatively recent innovation in how families are done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that a lot of that stems from, I think, if you have a nuclear family, they're very easy to move. To start a new job. You know, I think that it relates to a lot of the sort of economic pressures that we felt. But yeah, I mean, you know, I know sort of my like family in Korea, like historically, you know, has been grounded a lot more in extended family relations. I know that that's common for a lot of, I think, people's families as well in the past. I think being able to ask your neighbor to kind of look after your kids for a little bit while you go run groceries is great. I think that having a community grounded in place really is the historical norm. And I think we're really feeling the acute lack of it today. And we're trying to make up for it in all these ways that I think are ultimately kind of unsatisfying because they don't actually get at what matters, which is, I think, this feeling of being embedded in a community and, you know, that extends beyond the borders of your family.
So are you now making it a practice to ask friends who might want to be parents someday by what means they would like to be parents?
I try not to do it too often. And I think as the hubbub around the article has reminded me, it is a very sensitive question. Only if we've been only very close friends. And I think only if it's within the sort of confines of, you know, us just kind of gabbing together. It's not taking it too seriously, I think.
Was there anyone that you felt who responded to the piece who really did listen to what you had to say but still found it very upsetting? Or were most of your critics people who just didn't want to countenance the idea that anything other than biological parenthood is the norm and, as you know, to use your word again, natural?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that, you know, It's a difficult piece to get. I think people would agree with points here and there, but ultimately feel like I was advocating for some view where everyone in the future is a test tube baby or something. And that's absolutely not what I'm advocating for. And so I think there was a mischaracterization there. There's an unfortunate sort of rise in really kind of like, just bad rhetoric and bad ideology out there. I seen people respond who got the idea that this was the sort of natural extension of anti-eugenicist thinking, and then went on to proclaim themselves pro-eugenics, and so somehow it was okay. And that was, I think, what really got me, where I there were people who seemed to understand the argument, but then all of a sudden did this 180 and sort of professed the views that, you know, explicitly this was kind of positioned against. So I think that we live in kind of an era of really kind of, I don't know, inflamed discourse. And I think that it's maybe a little bit difficult to kind of read something like this with a kind of more neutral kind of lens. But I mean, I suppose that's kind of the nature of things these days.
Sounds like you have fodder for plenty of essays to come.
I don't think I'll run out anytime soon.
Leo Kim is an ideas contributor at Wired, where you can find his essay, Preferring Biological Children is Immoral. It's part of Wired's series about the future of morality, which is called The Next Normal. Leo, it's been really interesting to talk with you. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.